the arts sector has been an interesting and pressing concern to one of being very deeply urgent concern at the same time as we're all beginning to worry how we're going to get through the next couple of years. And I know there'll be a lot of conversation about that over the course of the next couple of days and the conference, but I would urge us to take this opportunity to talk to the really extraordinary presenters that we have during the day and in the morning tomorrow who are going to help us really think from, you know, a much bigger and longer-term picture. Transformation takes a long time, and we have a short-term crisis, but we also have a long-term opportunity to really think about where we can help the art sector take itself over the next 10 years as it really emerges fully into the 21st century. So I'm hoping that our conversations today and tomorrow will take us there. We've structured this, I think when we designed this conference meeting design, we didn't know that we'd have 50 or so people, and we also didn't know we'd be in a theater-style room, and I really conceived of it as a roundtable where we are having a presenter and then one, or in one case, two kind of moderator respondents, and then we'll open it up to discussion. We really wanted all of these to be roundtable discussions. Having said that, each of the presenters has a very meaty presentation. You're going to get a lot of content today and in the beginning of tomorrow, and we will have time for questions and discussion after each presentation, although it might be slightly shorter. My plan is to stop talking in 1 minute when it's 10:30 and introduce Bill Ivey, our first keynote speaker, who will really, I think, start us off in a wonderful way by giving us a really aerial view of what the world looks like, the environment for arts and culture looks like right now. So let's say we will go from until the session was supposed to end at 11:15. We might still be able to get it to end maybe at 11:20 or 11:25. We'll just shave a few minutes off of each of the sessions and a few minutes off of lunch if we need to, and we will be on track. But I don't want to shortchange either the presenters or the discussion, so we'll just fill the space that we have. So having said that, you all have agendas in front of you now, I hope. There's some extras on the table in the center if you don't have one. You'll see who these fabulous people are, and I think their bios are in some of the material, but I just want to introduce Bill Ivey, who is going to launch us off. Bill is the director of the Curb Center for Art, Enterprise, and Public Policy at Vanderbilt University, and many of you may have known him previously as the chair of the National Endowment for the Arts, and before that as a longtime folklorist. And I'm losing my mind, Bill. What was the name of the organization you used to run? Fabulous Country Music Foundation. And Jim Smith, who's going to be the respondent and session moderator, is newly vice president and director of research and education at the Rockefeller Archive Center, and has been a key partner with those of us who have been convening these research and policy meetings since when? 1997? Is that the first one that we did, Jim? Well, not here, but at White Oak. Yeah, a long time ago. Anyway, I have a great day, and Bill Ivey, please take us away.
Thanks a lot, Mary, and it's great to be with you at an important meeting at an important time. You know, a couple of years ago, I chaired a gathering in Nashville of folklorists and oral historians and ethnomusicologists, and we were trying to plan for those disciplines. They're disciplines that that rarely have, if you're an ethnomusicologist or a folklorist, you are rarely in a university department where your name is on the door of the department. You're almost always, you know, part of English, part of anthropology, or so on. And we were talking about all these big issues, and at the end of the meeting, after I'd chaired it and waxed supposedly eloquently, they handed me a sweatshirt that they'd had fabricated that had across it with a lightning bolt, Captain Macro. And and I think that related to the idea, to the notion that I tend to operate from perhaps a 25 or 30,000 foot level. And I think that's where I'm going to be talking today. But I think it's very important, because when we talk about research, it's got to be for something. It's got to be in support of some idea. You know, as I prepared these remarks, I had occasion to look at an issue, and I wrote these about a month ago. I mean, I should have written these and then immediately sold everything in my 401k and got, but somehow I didn't put the two. As I prepared these remarks, I had occasion to look at an issue of Your Reader that came out almost exactly 2 years ago. It contained the very good AEA Irvine report on the arts in California, and I was drawn to the list of external influences cited at the beginning of the text. They include changing demographics, reluctance of government to fund public services, dominance of the market, new technologies, and a shift in the way the public values culture. These observations of the context surrounding the nonprofit arts were and remain accurate, of course, but from the vantage point removed by just a couple of years, the formulation appears too benign. It's clear that these influences represented, in a sense, the tip of an iceberg, specific manifestations of deep forces that are transforming the context in which all of us do our work. A number of major foundations are rethinking the depth and character of their commitment to the arts. At least one has significantly reduced national grant making. The current meltdown of our financial system, gosh, I wrote this a month ago, the current meltdown of our financial system is almost certain to exacerbate this trend. We should be so lucky as to face changing demographics as our greatest challenge. I believe that we're truly at a watershed in philanthropy that supports arts and culture. And further, I'm convinced that it will take leadership of the most coordinated, most thoughtful, most imaginative character if we are to advance, perhaps even to maintain, a significant relationship between foundation work and the U.S. art system. In the past, America's foundations have demonstrated the capacity to lead and the capacity to affect change, although the task will be daunting, and that's really what I'm going to be asking of you today. A number of you have heard me talk about challenges facing the arts in the U.S., and some of you may have read Arts, Inc., my assessment of the health and possible future of cultural rights in the U.S. art system. However, today I want to put a finer point on those arguments, direct them straight at this audience in order to address three things. First, how can we frame the current situation in a way that truly helps us understand the nature of the problem and the character of the choices we face? One. Second, if we turn that watershed metaphor on its side to imagine our cohort of grant makers in the arts standing instead at a fork in the road, what opportunities lie down each path? And finally, what are a few of the down and dirty obstacles to success that are likely to be encountered as we work our way toward a robust vision of 21st century arts grant making? I noticed a couple of months ago that my friend Bob Lynch of Americans for the Arts has begun to use the number 100,000 when indicating the total number of cultural nonprofits in the U.S. We all know that the equivalent figure from the 1960s was something on the order of 6,000. This dramatic increase in the number of nonprofit arts organizations is the most visible and lasting achievement of what John Kreidler a decade ago labeled the Ford era. Now, I will not bore this crowd by reciting evidence that the Ford era is coming to an end, that the nonprofit sector is, as I have put it in the past, overbuilt, or that conservative programming, difficulty in leadership recruitment, flattening attendance, reduced reserve funds, and the like are signs that the period in which supporting the arts meant building institutional capacity by funding supply-driven nonprofits in the fine arts, that era is coming to a close. Contraction is already underway. I mean, I just saw in the LA Times within the last week a piece that mentioned that nearly half of the 80 or so major dance companies in the U.S., what the LA Times refers to as the canary in the mine, that's where they refer to dance, of arts organizations have actually downsized during the past decade. Half. You know better than I the multiple symptoms that are showing up among your individual grantee partners. After all, like families, each cultural organization is unhappy in its own way. Instead of describing that problem, though, I'd like to dig into it a bit to figure out why our 20th century funding model has topped out. And if my argument convinces you, talk about what real-world factors will have to be addressed if we are to make policy choices that will enable travel to and beyond our looming fork in the road. Now, I want to say in preparing these remarks, I returned to a paper I had written and to one written by Jim Smith and another by Adrian Ellis, papers commissioned by the Wallace Foundation, part of a rethinking of their arts programming that they're involved in right now. And Jim's paper in particular stimulated my thinking, so I want to acknowledge his help in this regard. To describe the situation of our art sector, I'm going to borrow and perhaps slightly modify concepts from two disparate fields, economics and law. Back in 1957, an economist named Richard Musgrave, a household name to each of you, I know, was conducting research into the way U.S. federal agencies prepared budgets. His analysis ultimately appeared in a 1959 book, The Theory of Public Finance. As you know, economists talk mostly about two kinds of goods, the products or services that are exchanged or made available in the economy. There are private goods provided by the marketplace and available to purchasers, hamburger buns, automobiles, Caribbean cruises, and the like. There are also public goods that are either free, like sunlight, or provided by the government. Public goods are first available to all, and second, when a public good is consumed by one person, that consumption doesn't prevent someone else from consuming the same good. In economic terms, they are non-rivalrous. Government-provided public goods are things like national defense, street lighting, and the judicial system. To consume national defense doesn't, you know, you consume it, your neighbor can also consume it. Maybe a bad example. In the course of examining government finance, Musgrave observed something different. He saw the hand of government in the economy influencing the consumption of goods and services that were not public goods, but in fact resembled everyday private goods. Musgrave proceeded to describe a new kind of good, one that exhibits some characteristics of a public good and some of a private good. He called these merit goods. And this is what Jim was, in a few lines, talking about. Things like free public education, subsidized housing for the poor, or airports and the system of air traffic control. While merit goods can generally be purchased like private goods, I mean, individuals, after all, I have some friends who have built their own airports, government experts determine that the quantity or distribution provided by market forces alone is inadequate. So subsidies are applied to increase availability or consumption. Now, to make the point a little finer, the reverse is also true. By the 1960s, Musgrave had expanded, refined his thinking about merit goods to include what he termed demerit goods, parts of the economy like cigarette smoking, where government intervenes to actually reduce consumption or availability of a product or service. So merit goods, or demerit goods for that matter, possess an interesting dual character. They can be purchased and consumed like private goods, and in that sense, they benefit the purchasers. But the extent of consumption is analyzed and manipulated, usually by government experts, in relation to an overarching, diffuse set of public benefits that justify this tinkering with markets. Now, what empowers government experts to intervene in the marketplace? What's the source of authority? To enable consumers to maximize satisfaction by consuming goods. I would argue that things like subsidized housing for the poor, free school lunches, free counseling sessions for troubled teens are justified by social norms. Arenas of agreement among citizens or consumers that there exists sufficient public benefit to make government interference in the supply of certain goods and services acceptable. Now, the concept of norm is used all over the place. Sociology, economics, philosophy, and law, each discipline uses it a little differently. I will rely on a kind of general notion. A norm is an arena of agreed-upon importance. Now, these arenas of agreement can be strong or relatively weak. The norm that citizens should not take one another's property is strong. Setting the law aside, if you left a cell phone on the table and you went out to the restroom and came back, it's still going to be there, or if it's not there, it's going to be lost and found somewhere. Someone's not going to walk off with it. Likewise, the norm against littering is strongly held and probably quite resilient, even if you had research that showed that Americans spend a lot of time on strategies to prevent littering, you would still be unlikely to just start throwing soda cans out your car window. Other norms, however, are less firmly held. There are norms that exist merely because citizens have vague knowledge. They observe societal leaders engaging in an activity that seems to make sense. For example, many people believe that foreign cars are better made or more economical than domestic cars. It's widely assumed that breastfeeding conveys health benefits to recipient infants. Though widely held, few of the believers can cite specific evidence or research to support such assumptions. My Vanderbilt Law School colleague Stephen Hechter labels such norms epistemic, I guess in the sense of being knowledge-based. And it's clear that while they are widely held, they are not as thick as those norms that discourage theft or littering or norms that encourage us to stop and help a fellow motorist in trouble. The foreign car norm, for example, though it's very widespread, is thin. After all, despite the assumption, say, that many in this room have, that Volvos are especially safe and therefore serve as appropriate starter vehicles for teenage drivers, that norm would be readily abandoned if a consumer encountered research that clearly demonstrated otherwise. So it's easy to see that norms, in a sense, can create demand for a product or service. A strong norm regarding the dangers of HIV infection, linked to the norm of care for the less fortunate, justifies the discounting of antiviral medicines in poor countries. I believe you see where I'm going with this talk about merit goods and norms. Obviously, the entire U.S. nonprofit system can be characterized as an effort to institutionalize merit goods by endowing their purveyors with permanence and legal standing. By conferring, and it's interesting that, of course, nonprofit status by decades precedes Musgrave's identification of merit goods. But by conferring nonprofit status on a wide range of businesses, government is in effect saying that even though your product may function as a private good that benefits a small group of individual purchasers, there exists sufficient indirect diffuse public benefits, so you will be relieved of the burden of taxation and will be afforded other advantages that will make your service or product widely available in the marketplace. It's obvious that a symphony concert, for example, is a private good. The event benefits purchasers, ticket buyers. However, there exists a norm that the presence of a symphony in a community and the availability of classical music affords these diffuse public benefits that justify support in excess of what ticket sales alone could provide. Now, described in this way, your foundations are doubly meritorious. You are nonprofit organizations that deliver the merit good, that is grants, that support other merit goods, the purveyors of arts through nonprofit institutions. In fact, were Musgrave to look at foundations, he would no doubt view them as government surrogates, private actors who can be trusted to apply expertise and judgment to marketplace interventions that advance a public interest. Put another way, in carrying out their mission, foundations are continually adjusting grant making to match the importance of different merit goods and the relative strength of the norms that justify them. Now, I've taken quite a bit of time, yours and mine, to work up the idea of merit goods and epistemic norms, because I believe the combination gives us an explanatory framework that will help us diagnose and analyze our current problem and then perhaps help us figure out how to act. For example, when I say now, 15 minutes into my remarks, the nonprofit arts are a weak merit good supported by a thin epistemic norm, you now understand what I have in mind. And of course, I believe that is exactly the case. This formulation explains a reality we face all the time. Budget levels for public and foundation support of the arts that continually seem to bump up against low kind of glass ceiling limits. Gallup and other polls that report high percentages of citizen support for public funding of the arts and for arts education, but yet in practice, culture inevitably gets subsumed beneath other priorities. So the norm is there, but it's not a very strong one. The arts lose out to more robust merit goods sustained by stronger norms. So today, the low-grade flu experienced by the nonprofit arts, that's Doug McLennan's phrase of Arts Journal, low-grade flu, can be interpreted as the inevitable condition that arises when a weak merit good with a thin norm expands to or beyond its natural limits. And because today other merit goods backed by more robust norms dominate public policy and foundation giving, think the Gates Foundation, Warren Buffett, healthcare, the environment, education, and so on, it's not sufficient for those of us who care about the arts to simply relax within a comfortable status quo niche. Remember, we've already seen that many of our foundations are rethinking culture, and the tendency has too often been to kind of devalue art as that reevaluation takes place. So leaders today, and I view program officers in art, media, and culture as key leaders, need to find ways to advance culture and art as strong merit goods. We need to justify our convictions with compelling argument and evidence, expanding and deepening the norm that sustains public and philanthropic support. The problem with this is that we end up having to make some choices. So as I move on, we begin to wrap up my remarks, I want to restate that second question. If we are at a fork in the road, what do the two paths look like? What do we gain or lose choosing one direction instead of another? One, of course, one direction is to continue our established route, discovering new sources of support, new business models, crafting new arguments for maintaining or even expanding the existing capacity of nonprofit fine arts organizations, get more people to buy into our current norm, strengthening the nonprofit arts as a merit good. And I would argue that we've been traveling that road for a while. Most obviously, and I think the merit good norm formulations really help unpack this strategy, we've poached on the norms of other merit goods, adding value to the arts by claiming that arts engagement makes young people more capable in math, or that training students in a hot box glass studio prevents juvenile delinquency, or that paintings deployed on hospital walls help patients heal more efficiently, or that strong nonprofit organizations are magnets attracting a creative class, and on and on. We embrace such claims because they offer the allure of a kind of merit good safe harbor. The nonprofit arts are bigger and more important if they are part of education, part of healthcare, part of economic development, or transportation, or some other domain that benefits from the support of a widespread, deeply held norm. We've been at this long enough to generate some pushback arguments. We were all dismayed when the RAND study, Gifts of the Muse, Harvard's Project Zero sort of deflated some of our poaching claims. And we felt that we had been there and done that when they said we need to talk about intrinsic value. So that may not work. But a second strategy, and I'll just mention it, is sort of new business models. And Adrian Ellis, again in his Wallace paper, defined this as a robust way of generating new sources of net income that are mission congruent. He's skeptical about the possibility of these new business models. He notes that you need a certain skill set to exploit. You have to have an asset, you have to have sufficient capital, and you have to have entrepreneurial skill, and that cultural nonprofits tend not to be strong in any of these areas, and that talk of a new business model might be a kind of displacement activity, diverting us from the real problem. Now, there are some great things that can be done. The Memphis Symphony has a wonderful project with Federal Express. Here in Atlanta, the symphony has just added another amphitheater, and so it's in the presentation business in a new way. Maybe a risky business, but these are things that at least are models that may help generate that 7% of new revenue. Now, for funders, there's nothing wrong with supporting these kinds of projects and helping nonprofits execute programs that justify themselves by using the value language of healthcare, education, so on. And we've got to be realistic. Using new arguments and new business practices to pump up the old system will at best produce mostly small effects on the margin. And such strategies will have to compete in an increasingly challenging funding environment, again, dominated by Gates-style priorities. And we're going to look with an economy at a lower set point, and that will reduce foundation assets. And again, that could encourage the migration of grant making from arts to these other priorities. So what's the other path? I'd argue that our alternative is to step back, and this relates to some of my arguments in Arts, Inc., that our alternative is to step back and view the art system as broadly as possible in order to craft a new merit good around culture, one that can be supported by a deeply held norm shared by a larger cohort of citizens. In Arts, Inc., I argue that that process will involve identifying compelling public benefits that derive from a healthy arts system by marking the connections within culture that really define critical issues and putting forward some overarching theories that employ research to link these theories with real problems. My appearance is co-sponsored by whatever public policy program is there. Jim Smith made the point in his paper that public policy folks or the students don't see culture in public policy terms. And I'm basically trying to go bird by bird, advancing the idea of cultural policy as an underdeveloped but fruitful domain of U.S. public policy. Now, I think there's an interesting template there. There's a set of issues that are unique to the cultural sector. Duration of copyright, the scope of fair use, government support for artists and for cultural nonprofits, trade and cultural goods, media regulation, an open and accessible internet, mergers in cultural industries, access to cultural heritage owned by corporations, equity in access to arts education and arts learning, access to art and artists of the world, and choice in the consumption of arts products. In the U.S. arts system, government authority and responsibility linked to these issues is scattered among all kinds of different agencies, Copyright Office in the Library of Congress, the federal and state courts, the NEA, the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative, the FCC, the Department of Homeland Security, think immigration, and Walmart. Although each issue is now treated separately in terms of the legislative language defining the work of different agencies, their true significance is linked because in aggregate, the resolution of many individual issues related to those themes defines the character of our underlying cultural system. For example, the merger of Sony and BMG that combined century-old vaults of our Trade Commission, like any other 4-3 or 3-2 merger, by assessing its likely impact on consumer price. I'd argue that such a merger should primarily be appraised in the light of cultural impact. How does a merger influence equity and access to heritage recordings? So I argue that by elevating the role of cultural policy in legislation, regulation, marketplace practice, we will strengthen our art system, advance public purposes, and introduce policy leaders and policy students to an exciting realm of theory and research. Now, in Arts, Inc., I put forward a Bill of Rights. I'll read you what the six rights are. And they're not rights in the sense in the old UN or UNESCO Declaration of Human Rights sense, but I'll just read them quickly. I think they function as assertions to try to establish territory that specialists in culture control. One is the right to heritage, the right to explore music, literature, drama, painting, and dance that define both our nation's collective experience and our individual and community traditions. Second is the right to the prominent presence of artists in public life. I'll just cut these a little short. Third is the right to an artistic life, the right to the knowledge and skills needed to play a musical instrument, draw, dance, and so on. Fourth is the right to be represented to the rest of the world by art that fairly and honestly communicates America's democratic values and ideals. Fifth is the right to know about and explore art of the highest quality and to the lasting truths embedded in those art forms. And sixth is the right to healthy arts enterprises that can take risks and invest in innovation while serving the community and the public interest. There are also a couple of theoretical concepts that show up in Arts, Inc. First is the idea of expressive life. It's a component of human behavior that's identified by a balance of heritage and individual voice. Cultural heritage gives us a sense of belonging, of community, a sense of continuity and connection with the past, who we are, how we relate to our neighbors. Voice is the other half of expressive life. This is autonomy, personal achievement, distinction, and freedom. When citizens have access to a cultural system that frames a healthy, expressive life by providing access to both heritage and voice, our society exhibits cultural vibrancy, a public good in a democracy. In other words, our cultural rights are fulfilled. Because access to creative heritage and to the tools of art and art making enhance identity and voice, a vibrant cultural scene can be linked today to important new research on positive psychology, happiness, and what constitutes a high quality of life in a post-consumerist economy. And certainly we're heading toward a post-consumerist economy. And then finally, I think there are a few looming social issues that this approach can address. It can be an economical path to a high quality of life for older citizens and for young people who are even now shaping lives in a challenging economic environment. Certainly, a new engagement between government action and art can be a path to a healthy 21st century public diplomacy, cultural diplomacy regime, one that provides a unique arena in which to identify overarching shared interests that transcend policy conflict. And finally, challenging media, internet, and intellectual property legislation and regulation in the light of cultural impact will initiate a much-needed pushback against high-price art permission system that's really dismantling America's cultural commons. Now, this has all been 50,000-foot stuff. I said I was going to go to 30,000 feet. I went to 50,000 feet. What can foundations and art leaders within foundations actually do in order to reinvent culture as a merit good of critical importance? If we decide to follow this path, advancing a robust model of cultural policy in order to secure a vibrant art system as a public good, what should we do? Well, first, on the national level, and I mentioned this sort of in passing in my book, but I've been talking about it a lot more. I think we should argue on behalf of the creation of a cabinet-level Department of Cultural Affairs. We will not have meaningful, coordinated connection between government policy and the art system until we develop some kind of central hub around which to argue public interest. I think environmental policy flourishes in Master of Public Policy programs, in part because the EPA provides an arena for policy debate, research, and implementation. And you have environmental journalists attached to major newspapers, I think in part because the EPA exists and it can be tracked and monitored. And this is not beyond your reach. Remember, if we scroll back 30, 40, 50 years, foundations possess a distinguished history of developing policy domains around education, healthcare, and social services, and then handing those responsibilities off to government agencies. I think it's time to do the same for culture, and I think there will be an opportunity in an Obama-Biden administration. Second, on both the national and community level, we need to argue on behalf of an open internet accessible to all. Cultural content is migrating to the digital realm and toward handheld, internet-dependent devices that integrate communication, entertainment, and information. This is where culture is heading. All cultural actors, including our longtime nonprofit partners, will be forced to navigate at least some elements of this emerging, converged system. So we must begin to think of the arts realm as an arena that includes media, internet access, and intellectual property, supporting community projects, because I know most of you work in communities, community projects that improve the quality of art systems, not just the quality or quantity of nonprofit services. And I think fair access to internet services in your community is a critical arts issue. Further, the cost of participation in this kind of access is increasingly making culture available only on a high-priced rental basis. And I think foundations and their partners, again, locally and nationally, can be vocal proponents of equity and access in relation to the internet, cable television, and so on. Now then, I think third, funders can demonstrate the significance of cultural vibrancy by assessing the state of the art system within our own communities and by investing in and partnering with a wider range of actors than has been our habit. This will require the creation of community cultural studies and arts action plans that look beyond our usual cohort of nonprofit partners to note the penetration of live music in nightclubs, how many foreign films are showing at the multiplex, what's music learning like in private studios and in retail establishments like Guitar Center, how many independent bookstores are in your community, as well as tracking the availability and affordability of things like high-speed internet and cable television. Our colleagues at the Urban Institute have been steadily moving their analysis of communities in this direction, but I think we need to do much more. Now, there are obstacles as I wrap up. Obviously, we're talking about new definitions of your sector. This may mean making a new kind of case to your president or to your board. This will not be entirely comfortable. After all, I doubt that there's anyone in this room, even me, no one in this room really got into this work of arts grant making in order to worry about bar bands or Comcast or whether Barnes & Noble was outcompeting your locally owned book retailer. But we have to overcome resistance to our weak norm. And I think, sadly, you know, boards take on faith the importance of the environment, public education, and healthcare. In our sector, in arts and culture, we still have to go in and make the case. But I think if we work toward a central federal hub dedicated to advancing the public interest in a vibrant cultural system, and if we actually demonstrate value by pursuing a broad agenda of public purposes around art in our own communities, we can revitalize art and culture as a merit good, grounded in a new and widely shared and deeply held norm. Now, I'm not dismissing poaching on others, norms and merit goods. And I'll conclude by saying, Yogi Berra, who famously, I always think of, I don't know why I'm thinking about this, he said, if you don't go to his funeral, he won't come to yours, which I always thought was a great line. But Yogi was famous for these meaningful statements that were sort of slightly off-center. And he once said, when you come to a fork in the road, take it. And I used that. I was speaking in Chicago and used that as a conclusion of a talk. And someone came up to me after the talk and said, I knew Yogi. And when he said that, he was talking, he was giving direction to his house. And he had a house that was at the end of two roads. They came apart, and then they came back together at his house. So we are at a fork in the road, and I think it is time for us to take it. So thank you.
Thank you, Bill. And is the microphone on? Yes, it is. Good.
I'm now joining Jim over here. I'm giving him back his book that I borrowed.
Yeah. He will sign it at some point. This is quite a remarkable gathering. When I think back to a GIA session in San Francisco probably 10 years ago, we had a breakfast roundtable on research and policy, and it really was a table with maybe 8 or 10, perhaps as many as 14 people if you counted the ones standing in the doorway who quickly wandered off. So I think it's a measure of how far this sector has come in appreciating research and in thinking about this as a policy domain. It's really quite gratifying when we see the numbers here. The other thing I want to say by way of introduction is that if you read only one book this year, in fact, you're pretty limited in your reading.
What a brilliant man this is.
But if you read only one book this year, shame on you. But this is the book that I was waiting for in trying to teach about cultural policy at UCLA. Have I held it up long enough?
You have.
Okay. It is an important book. It's what we have been waiting for, I think, to see how robust a field cultural policy can be. The other thing I will say by way of introduction is that having come from a foundation board meeting of this week where we did not talk about program at all, where we met with all three of our financial advisors and devoted the entire day to the financial markets, it's hard to talk about this sector without the backdrop of a financial context that I think all of us now understand is as severe as anything we would have faced had we been in foundations in 1929 or 1930, and where none of us know what the road ahead is going to look like. If there are forks in it, pick up the fork. You may be eating the can of beans with that fork. I'm changing your metaphor there.
But buy the book first. But
if you can get credit. I don't know what Amazon is doing these days. I'm not going to speak at great length. We didn't confer about his presentation. We've already talked on the bus, talked over breakfast, and we had a couple of days together at Wallace to talk about some of these issues. I had not heard this paper. This is like the magician who said, I don't know you. I've never seen you before, and the magic trick that will follow. I want to say, I guess, four, maybe five things if I get to them. The work that Bill has done is helping us to think about how to move the arts and the discussion of culture from diversion, mere diversion, I'm using a word from his introduction, to public policy, And in moving from public policy, he's helping us think about whether we can assert a claim of right about our cultural life. That's the trajectory that we're working toward. Now, the first critical thing I'm going to say is about this claim of right. It is a wonderful way to organize a book. It is not yet well-grounded in traditional democratic theory. Rights in democratic theory define those private realms of individual action from which we are protected against state incursion. So this is right more as metaphor than something grounded in democratic theory, and I think Bill would agree with that. Another way of seeing right is in terms of reciprocity and the obligations that we fulfill in order to obtain those rights. I think this is much more helpful and can propel our discussion of culture toward a discussion of civic engagement and civic duty for all of us, not merely the professional artist. And the third thing I will say is it is a wonderful way to frame a book and to set out the ingredients of a policy domain. And to date, we have not defined this as a policy domain that is as expansive as it ought to be. We have defined it primarily in terms of education, to some extent in terms of community development, but not in the much, much broader ways that Bill has just described. Second thing I want to do is to say a bit more about merit goods. This is the second year that we have had a session where merit goods have been discussed. And I want to explain a little bit of how I came to use this concept to think about culture. I did devote a few sentences to it in the Wallace paper. I've said much more about it in a paper for Aspen that Brookings will publish one of these days, in which I was asked to look back at how foundations have affected our arts and cultural life. And as a historian, I went back to the late 19th century. And it seemed to me that the only way to understand the role that foundations had played and to understand some of the paths, the wrong paths that have been taken, was to reintroduce this concept of merit good. Now, I was teaching at Georgetown. I talked with the public finance people, delved into about seven or eight different public finance texts, and was immediately told by the public finance people today, oh, we dismiss the concept of merit goods. We don't use it anymore. And I thought, you guys have taken the wrong path. This is a very useful concept. And if we can resurrect it to understand what the philanthropic community ought to be doing and how culture is situated in our lives, we will have a theoretical frame that I think can advance our work. What the concept of merit good does for me, and Bill, in adding the notion of epistemic norms, has elaborated on something that I had not even thought to elaborate, which is why 15 years of conversation back and forth about this is a good thing. I think the notion of merit good pushes us from the public goods terrain, acknowledging that there is a cultural marketplace that encompasses both nonprofit and for-profit institutions. It gives us now a theoretical grounding to understand that. It gives us a way of understanding individual participation in this marketplace. It suggests some interventions that would stimulate demand, other interventions that might help us to understand why merit goods are valued by some individuals and not by others. It compels us then to ask about values. Why are these goods valued by some, not by others? Why do some people see the individual benefit? And then, because of the merit good concept, we have to ask, what are the diffuse effects of these goods? How do they spill over into the rest of society? And I think in some strange way, the notion of merit good can alter the way we think about our approaches to government in asking for public policy interventions. It mandates a different approach to public policy. I'll say more about that in a minute. The other thing that it does is to reorient our philanthropic thinking, and this is the historian's insight now, from looking toward government, toward looking to how the market functions. And this about face, reorienting ourselves toward the marketplace, I think is a particularly important thing for us to contemplate in these new market conditions. Oddly enough, I came to the resurrection of this concept when I was asking what foundations did during the Great Depression. As market realities changed for the Metropolitan Opera and for so many other cultural institutions, it was clear that they were not going to be able to make a public goods claim. And in those circumstances, I guess there's some irony recovering this concept in our new Great Depression. The other thing that it does, the concept of merit good, thanks to Bill's notion of epistemic norms, asks how we as a philanthropic sector can thicken those norms. The next thing I'll say, I'm going to come back to that. How do we approach public policy in the cultural arena? There are three things. I won't say much about this, but Bill has begun to outline what that domain encompasses. He has given us a linked system, a linked set of issues where public benefit is at stake. He has given us a way of thinking, and we talked about this on the bus, of how you create a policy community. How do you embed thinking about culture in a public policy realm where numbers seem to matter, quantitative skills seem to matter, and where other domains have more saliency? As he pointed out, and this is what I've written a lot about, how are policy domains created? They accrete around bodies of research. They accrete around systematic collection of data. And they develop a kind of intellectual vitality where theoretical questions are at stake. We have not had that in this domain. And we have to begin to move from data to theory. We have to find a way of creating a more robust community of scholars working in this area and of scholars who are speaking to practitioners. And as we know from looking at other policy domains, and I'm simply reinforcing what Bill has said, the nature of the policy community is often a reflection of where the locus of decision-making in government is. In this sector, it has been so diffuse. The numbers of agencies involved have been so fragmented that there is no nexus for that discussion. It's interesting that I think 10 years ago you were against that notion because it was much easier to hide the cultural appropriations in 30 different places. But you do need a hub for conversation and activity. So I hope we can talk a bit more about how a policy community can be constructed. This is what I skipped over, but I want to go back to it. Bill has introduced the notion of an expressive life, and I think that's a useful concept to begin with. He slid over a term that we talked about a lot this summer. The term is vibrancy. What do we mean by a vibrant cultural life? I think that's the question I'd put on the table for this group, for Bill perhaps to elaborate on. It would be a good place to end, but it's not the last thing I'm going to say. And this is where now, having sort of stepped out of the philanthropic world or direct, I can't really say that, can I? I keep coming back to these meetings. As a historian, looking at where foundations have made a difference, with the Aspen Project on Foundation Impact, I have been dismayed in the post 9/11 world about philanthropic leadership generally, and leadership especially in the cultural sector. When I look back at what some of the great foundations were doing in the international cultural arena in the 20s and 30s, as they created the predicate for so many of our international exchange programs, as they led the way for government, I have not seen a foundation step up to international leadership at a time when international leadership has been, shall we say, deficient in Washington. We've missed an opportunity there. We've missed it in cultural diplomacy, to be sure. We've missed it in cultural exchange. We are the instruments of soft power, and we've disarmed ourselves in the international arena. And I think it's a shameful thing in our sector. I think there are opportunities, though. And the one opportunity that I'd like to underscore, as the odds on an Obama administration grow stronger, and as I think of what my students have talked about and been most interested in, it's the notion of national service. And there are some exciting opportunities in the national service arena where a few valiant people are talking about how the arts can be brought in to the wider schemes of national service. And looking at the younger generation that over the past 5 years teaching at Georgetown, I've tried to bring along into this arena, or looking at some of the undergraduates I've interacted with, the opportunities for civic engagement are the things that compel them. And I would hope, as an arts and cultural community, that we can find ways of using culture as a mechanism for that more vibrant civic engagement. So I'll end on that note. And I know there are questions. The Merit Good seminar can continue. It's so exciting to hear Richard Musgrave's name mentioned here. Let him enter the pantheon with Will Baumol and Bill Bowen. So I'm sure there are questions. And we can hardly see through these lights beyond, we're picking out silhouettes. So if we don't identify you by name, even though we know you.
While you're formulating the question, I thank Jim. It's always great to have a really smart guy tell you what you were saying, because now I understand myself a lot better. And he's played that role before. I think the idea of expressive life has real practical implications. You know, this notion of heritage as identity, artistic heritage as identity. How do we give communities and families, citizens, access to heritage so they know who we are and who their neighbors are? And this notion of art as freedom, as autonomy, as an opportunity for personal achievement. These are both concepts that I think are critical to happiness. To me, one of the challenges that policy leaders face is the Ninth Ward of New Orleans, where we know there existed a vibrant life, and it was not merely grounded in material well-being. And it's interesting to me the way policy leaders are boggled by the idea of trying to reconstruct or revitalize a vibrant neighborhood that was devastated by a hurricane, when everyone knows that what was lost was something other than what money can buy. And I think the reason that action is so frozen is in part because we've lost the ability to talk about immaterial things as aspects of a high quality of life. I'm fortunate to be a trustee of the Center for American Progress, and John Podesta, who was my boss, he was Bill Clinton's chief of staff, is the president of that organization. And of all these policy wonks talking about quality of life in a progressive democracy, and they always talk about material well-being or things that lead directly to material well-being. It's either jobs or it's education in order to get people jobs. And I try to explain that progressivism, if you go back to the 19th century and its roots in the arts and crafts movement, has a strong arts component. It has a quality of life component that's not about material well-being. And it was initially a pushback against the excesses of industrialization, and I think there's probably a need for a similar kind of pushback against the isolating coldness of a digital age, which everybody just stares at their cell phone or their computer screen. The opportunity that I see is that whatever administration comes in next, and I'm confident it will be a Barack Obama administration, which will make this easier, but any administration is going to be grappling for an initiative that's relatively affordable, that is affordable, that can in some way galvanize citizen action around some kind of collective purpose. I think Jim's notion of national service is a good one. I think art and culture can be right in the center of that. But I think simply gathering up the things that government does around arts and culture into a single initiative about restoring key American values, rediscovering our true identity, is an Obama-style initiative, and I think it's something that foundations can, in which you can play a leading role. It's not only about money; it's about voice and about making arguments and talking within your own boards and within your own staffs about the meaning of a vibrant, expressive life as a public good. I'll say one last thing. I think that there's a wonderful kind of arena of research that's developing that's around happiness and quality of life, and it's grounded in the notion that there's plenty of research that says material well-being after a rather low set point doesn't make people any happier as you make them richer or give them a bigger house and so on. I'm a little troubled because this is an arena of research that's growing, and the arts are very much on the periphery, and where I think we should be right in the middle of it. And I'm hoping that any of you who have an opportunity to support that kind of research or to work with those researchers would at least encourage them to look hard at art and art making as a component of a high quality of life and move away simply from family, workplace, and religion. So I think there are real opportunities for this field to lead, and really maybe over the next four years, in part for the wrong reasons. I mean, if you have to craft a high quality of life in an economy that's reset so that everyone is poorer, where do you go? Where does policy intervene in ways that can actually give people an enhanced quality of life without it costing an arm and a leg or without depending on them to get equity in their homes to try to buy it? And I think that there is an opportunity for us to gather up there. Now you have your questions.
Yes. I wonder if you've run across those conversations and if you've thought about the relationship of the concept of public value of the arts to the business of approaching the arts as a merit good.
I'm not familiar with Jerry. I mean, I'm familiar with Jerry and his work generally. I'm not familiar with that conversation. Now, And not having familiarity with it, I don't know to what extent I should comment. I do think that looking at the cultural life of a community more broadly, I know Americans for the Arts is churning away on figuring out indicators of sort of cultural vibrancy that are very broad, and I think a lot of folks are working on it. It's the challenge, as I mentioned in my prepared remarks, for us is to, you know, almost everybody I know in the arts got into it because they love the arts, and usually it's people who love one aspect of the fine arts, and they've kind of shifted out of being a performer or a manager or whatever into the philanthropic side, or they work for the NEA or whatever, or a state arts agency. And I think we're just going to have to really think about the fun of saying, okay, we're also going to worry about intellectual property. We're also going to worry about whether the people in the poor part of town have good high-speed internet access so that they can be engaged in this digital world. And I think that Jerry, to the extent that he's pushing research in that direction, I think is because, you know, he's a big consultant. I think that's really helpful. Oh, no.
I'm not sure either. Again, coming from a board meeting this week, I'm not sure that our grant program had adapted to the realities that we faced in the last 2 weeks. Perhaps the most terrifying thing at that board meeting was to hear from a vice chairman of one of the major financial houses that we deal with, someone who's been on Wall Street for between 40 and 50 years, to say, I don't know where the bottom is. He would have said last Friday was the bottom. And he said, I've been wrong over the last 2 weeks. Nothing in my experience tells me where the economy is headed or how we're going to get out of it or whether it's going to be a decade as the decade of after 1929 with, you know, a fake boom in 37, 38 was. I'm not answering the question about bringing theory to practice. I'm simply reflecting, I think, the uncertain economic times we're in. If there's any lesson from the Great Depression, it is that the cultural sector began to understand the multiple streams that flow into our institutions. And in understanding that, and in thinking back to 73, 74, where there isn't much hope, as foundation assets fell, that was a moment when government support was increasing. I'm very pessimistic about where we're going to be. I was pessimistic in 2000, 2001 as well, seeing the prospects of deflation. We have, though, to think about, as Bill pointed out at the beginning, the proliferation of institutions in this sector. I think we're going to have to acknowledge that some are going to go out of business. Some are going to die. We're going to have to think about consolidation. And that would be very high on my agenda. I don't think we're going to be able to subsidize audiences. I don't think the market, as it stands now, is going to be any kind of a salvation. Again, in the Great Depression, some institutions did, oddly enough, begin to find market solutions using new technologies, radio broadcasts of operas. Maybe there are creative things to think about there, but maybe it's just the dire couple of weeks we've been through. But I'm not optimistic, and I haven't rethought anything programmatically.
Yeah, and let me answer it a slightly different way. I agree completely with Jim, and I would say it's a little bit, you know, it's kind of a doing two different things at the same time. I can't do it. All the while I was running the Country Music Foundation, you know, the Country Music Hall of Fame is a nonprofit with a library and a museum, very dependent on earned income. Vernacular culture in the U.S. doesn't get much traction with normal philanthropy. You know, that's another paper for that. But all the while I was running that organization, we were always desperately afraid at year end. Will we be in the red? Will we be in the black? How do we survive? What kinds of exhibits will pull people in? On and on. But at the same time, I was always out there trying to say, well, you know, country music is an important part of American, you know, of America's musical heritage. We have to deal with vernacular as well as with the fine arts, and so you have to, I think, try to operate at maybe 20,000 feet and down at the ground level at the same time. You're going to have a strategy for your old partners, and this is something that you're going to have to work out within your own shop. In terms of how you deal with hard times, there's an element of triage, and there's two kinds of triage. One is, all right, we have these arts organizations, we're going to continue to fund the arts, but we're going to have to cut back in these ways. Everybody gets less, some get none, and some get what they need. That's an internal conversation. But there's another conversation that will go on, which is how does culture fit in as a priority within your overall foundation strategies. In good times, the arts can kind of be there the way they're often in the room as a sort of amenity. I had one leading staffer with a big foundation that supports the arts who said, you know, we're kind of rethinking things, but we're not going to really just walk away from the arts because we've got three or four board members who are also on the boards of the Symphony and the Art Museum. And so there's always going to be something there. Well, that's to me the thinnest kind of norm, you know, because what you want. And this is where the 50,000-foot stuff and Jim's reformulation of what I said to say that thinking about merit goods gets us to think about arts organizations operating in a marketplace. If you can talk to a president or a board, and I'm assuming most of you are not presidents but are program officers, and say our investment in culture is a key component of a high quality of life in this community. And it's the most efficient and effective way for us to produce a happy, civically engaged community. And here's why we know that. Here's why we think that, and here's why we know that. This is why we think a vibrant, expressive life is a public good right here in Omaha. To the extent you can do that, I think you start to protect your work internally because it becomes harder to say the arts are an amenity. We'll get back to them when we get more money. And, you know, Jim and I and Marion and Bob, a number of folks in this room, Joan Shigagawa, participated in these meetings, 10, 15 years ago, talking about where the art should be going and so on. And I think we had a process before we had a problem. And I wish we were doing those.
No, we had a place to meet.
We had a place to meet because of Jim, and we had a process. And what I realize we are, and this is maybe the case for every sector. Maybe if this were a meeting of automobile dealers, we'd be having very similar. You know, how do we sell a car when people don't have any money? You know, and we'd be talking about, well, we can talk about it's a better mileage. You know, all this. I think that like everybody, we tend to be. We get smart when we get scared. And I think we've tried to be smart when we weren't scared, but it's just hard to really get serious when, you know, oh, yeah, that's very interesting, you know. I often found I would walk into a room and give my little remarks, and he would say, that guy is really cute. Those are some cute ideas. Isn't he neat? I'd like to hear from him every couple of years, see what he's thinking. Nice to hear from you. And then, you know, you just go on and do it again. And so I think now this may be an opportunity. You know, Jim, I think foundation, I passed over this in my remarks, but I said it twice, but maybe foundations have led. Foundations have led. And I think there's going to be a policy vacuum. How do we address quality of life in a nation when we can't afford to pretend that we're going to buy it? You know? And I think a reinvestment in cultural heritage and art making as a avenue to a high quality of life in a post-consumerist democracy is an argument that we are in a position to make. And I think that there will be people on the other side looking for those kinds of ideas, because they just can't pretend they can run out and make people improve things by writing checks.
I have one thing to add to that, and we don't want to dominate, but we've got the microphone. It's interesting, again, thinking back to the other periods of crisis, and I'm thinking of two, the Great Depression and the 1970s. Culture got traction in those years, both in government and in the private sector, because we were thinking about American identity. It was part of the WPA efforts and the wonderful things coming out of the Library of Congress. It was part of Rockefeller Foundation programming. Similarly, in 73, 74, despite the crash, there was considerable rallying around around 76, you know, the bicentennial. And again, much thinking about what American culture meant. I think this will also be something coming out of this election cycle, this crisis, the conversation about identity, which is not just a domestic discussion, but one about American identity in the world. I offer that as a theme. Marion.
We probably need to wrap this session up.
Okay.
Can I take the liberty of...
We got the hook.
Question, the last question, and then we'll break and find more time.
Sure.
Well, I have two questions. My first is a comment about bringing the 30,000 feet down to the 10-foot level, which is that there is an opportunity going on now because of the interest, particularly at the city level, of mayors. Main not part of that conversation. The interest is in the creative sector, it's a battle between commercial interests and free and open access to media, diverse voices, and democracy, and the internet. So, in a way, we as TIA need to be a little bit more proactive. If we're going to get on the cutting edge and stay ahead, we have to get with our peers in other areas. When you get into actually working to operationalize as opposed to hearing the issues and saying, oh, that's interesting, I don't know what to do about it, you know, the rubber meets the road, it means that you have to, everybody's overworked and understand that you have to then say, okay, I'm going to take a piece of my mind share, a piece of my day, even a half a day, a month. I'm going to actually try to work this and do something about it as a focus, saying, or else it just goes along with how we get traction and interact is a major challenge and may not even be addressable.
Just a quick addition. That's just that note that GFAB, or Grand Nations of Film and Electronic Media, is very present in this conference. And they're here and they're doing sessions. And I think it is one way that we can make a connection with them.
I think if you look at the interventions that we've made in our cultural system that sort of have government and some policy leaders and advocates involved. You get funding for nonprofit organizations. You get media activism around ownership and internet access, and you get public broadcasting. Those are the and then arts education. Those four, and those have tended, although Joe mentioned otherwise this morning, but they've tended to say, you talk about media policy without talking so much about intellectual property. You talk about, they tend to be rather isolated. Something that the Ford Foundation funded the Curb Center, we started this 3 years ago, to do something in Washington called the Arts Industries Policy Forum. And we've just gone to the 30 different government entities that have some little slice of the cultural policy pie, and try to recruit one or two staff members from each, people who are interested in cultural questions. And this is the FCC, the U.S. Trade Representative's Office, Homeland Security, the Library of Congress, the Smithsonian Institution, the NEA. We have 55 members in this policy forum, and we don't get them all at every meeting. We get about 18 or 20 at every meeting, but we have, you know, wine and snack gatherings. And a guest who comes in and talks about a cross-cutting arts or cultural issue. Now, often these are things that have not normally been in the grant makers' realm. I mean, things like movie exports and how they affect the U.S. image abroad, or the Smithsonian's difficulty in bringing folk artists into the Festival of American Folklife when they're bringing them from other countries, and a range of. But the idea is to create a policy cohort. Among these senior career staff, only for career staff, not political appointees, and it's done on a bipartisan, policy-neutral basis, so we don't take positions. We try to get people from both parties. So we're dealing with Judiciary Committee, Commerce Committee staff, as well as people from agencies. Maybe something, you know, maybe a grant makers cultural policy forum that would talk about some of these, that would introduce some of these other issues in parallel, in tandem, with the things that you're more accustomed to dealing with. It might be a way to address it. You've got the people to do it, for sure.
Thank you.